Today's presentation is titled Civic Engagement and First Nations and Métis Peoples, Our Work as Allies. There are many opportunities for civic engagement in Regina. Certainly there are many issues that are shared for settlers, First Nations and Métis, and new Canadians. But how do we start to work together? How can I be a worker for social change in relation to First Nations and Métis people? Becoming an ally requires reflection and action. Where can I begin? Dr. Shawnine Peet grew up in the Lakeview neighborhood of Regina. She comes from the Little Pine First Nation. She's an educator and mother of three. Dr. Peet is a professor of educational administration and core studies in the Faculty of Education at the University of Regina.
Well, thank you so much. It's nice to be invited back. Tara sends her regrets. She's taking care of my dad today. I've asked her to stay with my dad for this next week because he just had bypass surgery, and he goes home today. So some of you met my youngest daughter, Tara, last time we were here. And so she's committed to family responsibilities today. My teaching work has reminded me of how important our relationships are, that I cannot do a whole lot from my position as a First Nations person in an urban setting without the allies that I work with. And certainly at the University of Regina, I work with many varied allies, not only in my faculty, but also throughout the university community. I also require my students to start to consider their own responsibilities for allied work. They still, as white middle-class students, still make up the vast majority of educators in our province, and I need them to be really well-schooled and understanding about relationships with First Nations and Métis kids, because I want to work with them to close the education gap for First Nations and Métis children in our province. And for me, that's a priority that I'm really outspoken about. I don't even apologize for it. I'll say, you know, I'm committed to this, and this is what, and this is how I want to engage with you differently. But certainly this past couple months has drawn Canadians all their attention to some of the changes that have been happening with the Harper government. And a number of conversations have been happening, certainly here in our city and in social media. And in early December, I was kind of busy. It was like doing my marking, trying to apply for tenure. Like, there was lots of stuff going on. And at the same time, I'm reading the newspaper, and I'm reading and listening to the radio and thinking about, what is this omnibus bill all about? And I started to be really concerned as I started to look deeper into it. And our kitchen table conversation started to center on, what does the omnibus bill mean for us as First Nations people living in Regina? What does it mean for our neighbors? And what does this mean for our relationships going forward? Because certainly we were going to have to teach some folks about what the concerns were. And a conversation on Facebook happened. And I know I was one of the many people who were asked to participate. But of course I was busy, right? Like, I had my head down trying to do my marking. And four women emerged. Sylvia McAdam, who'd been working with my dad on community-based issues around treaty rights in the North Battleford area. Sylvia entered into conversations with Sheila McLean. And Sheila is a settler woman from Saskatoon who was also very concerned about the environmental impacts and the potential for environmental impacts given the omnibus bill changes. She's a professor, and she teaches courses like I do in anti-racism. And then they engaged with Jess Gordon, and Jess Gordon is a First Nations woman, mother, who's concerned not only about the changes to the Indian Act, but also with the environmental issues. And then my friend Nina Wilson. And Nina is a traditional knowledge keeper from here. And with groups of women, she has offered many different ceremonies, including sweat lodge ceremonies, because she's a pipe keeper and a lodge keeper. And Nina, too, from her own positioning, entered into this conversation about what can we do with these issues that are coming forward. And so these four women, who kind of sort of knew each other, but not really, but shared a common concern decided to have a really critical conversation online. And from that movement, from those initial conversations, grew the Idle No More movement. And I see a t-shirt here that has it proclaimed, yes. Thank you for being an ally. So when we take a look at some of these common issues that we have and that we share, if I ask you the question, are you concerned about your drinking water? Kind of hard for us to say, no, I'm not concerned at all. Many of us, especially in Saskatchewan, and many of us in First Nations community, are very concerned about the quality of our drinking water. Many, about a third of our communities have boil water only warnings on their on the water, so they're actually having to bring water in. My dad was saying, for his own house, he spends about $100 a week on water. Okay, for a man who's on pension, who's 71 years old, his partner's in her late 60s, they don't work. And what they do is provide service to the community, as my dad's case, as an elder. And so to just get the $100 a week just for water is a pressing concern for him. And then ensuring that the quality of that water is good for him is another concern, because he doesn't always know whether it's that good. It looks clear, but it's got a funny taste. So there's many opportunities just on the very basics concerns that we have just for water or for the land, where we can start to work together as settlers and First Nations and Métis people and as new Canadians. But we need an opportunity. And one of the pieces that I love about coming back and being invited back to this community is I hear from you individually about the kinds of things you're currently engaged in, and I see the evidence on your bulletin boards of things that are growing concerns for you. And I see us naturally working together as allies. It doesn't mean that we always know how to approach. And my students on campus have often taught me that they don't even know what to call me. So they're really reluctant and nervous, and they'll come over and they'll say, Dr. Pete, I'd really like to do some work on First Nations, no Aboriginal. What do I call you? And so if that's their stumbling block, you know we're going to have to do a bunch of steps to get to a place where we're more comfortable working commonly and collectively together. So I try to help them get through that discomfort just on the surface of things. So another piece besides teaching them what to call me, I am Nian Nahiowen. I am a Cree woman. And when I'm in a mixed setting, I'll say I'm First Nations because it's an easier term. And if I am working more globally with other Indigenous people, I use the term Indigenous for those large collective kind of concerns that we share globally. So you can see my language shifts depending on the setting. If I'm reflecting back on my past, I'm an Indian, because back in the 70s and 80s, that was the term of the day, and my storying reflects that language shift over time. So I hope that helps just on the surface level to talk about some of the language that we use. The second piece that I have to work with my students on and with others that I'm working with is helping them to understand the distinction between treaties and the Indian Act. Because they seem to use those words interchangeably, and it's not accurate. And I think that confusion is part of the agenda. It's to help us be inaccurate in the things that we want to talk specifically about. So the treaties were a nation-to-nation agreement, and the Indian Act was created by the federal government to operationalize or administer the treaties. And so it became a huge institution, and they have, an $80 billion budget across Canada. And most of that budget is centered on the federal level out of Ottawa, but there's regional offices, and then there's local offices. So they've just been shifting things around again. And even though there's a regional office here in Regina, there's a local office in Fort Qu'Appelle. So if, as you can imagine, there's lots of employees all across Canada. There's over 5,000 of them. So a lot of the money for Indian Affairs gets streamed into the employment of those individuals. And that's another discussion. So I try to separate out for my students and for people who are curious to learn about First Nations and Métis issue that there's a couple different things at play here. There is certainly the treaty relationships, and then there's the way that it's been administered through the Indian Act. And part of the changes to the omnibus bill had to do specifically with the Indian Act. And there's some good stuff that's going to be removed. I mean, on the surface, it looks really positive. Like, they're going to take out the piece that says that Indian children all have to go to residential school. Okay? It was still in policy, even though it hasn't been actualized for some time. Okay? So they're going to remove that piece. That's a good thing. But there's some places where, in the Indian Act, changes that are coming forward, they didn't ask us. And one of those has to do with the Governance Act, the Self-Governance Act portion of it. So some bans are not treaty. They are Indian Act bans. And so what ends up happening is that they operate as self-governing organizations, much like a municipality would. So they get, there's a flow of funding that comes to them, and they're able to administer it that way. But not all bans want to let go of that relationship, because there's a fiduciary responsibility under the treaties for the federal government. And so that has some long-standing commitments and financial commitments going forward that look like they're going to be eroded under some of these bill changes. So First Nations people were concerned about those changes without involvement of First Nations people in the process. And so that's part of the movement, but certainly it's not the entire focus. As we're moving forward as allies, certainly part of the challenge has been that others are coming on board from their different organizations, and they're encroaching on this initial conversation that comes from a First Nations treaty standpoint, and they're bringing in other issues, and it's getting clouded sometimes. And lots of the feedback is that Idle No More is without focus. But it is also an organization, while it had four founders, it's become localized. And it's become not only localized, but it's also global. So there's leadership all over the place. And there's leadership in Regina and Fort Capel, and there's leadership in North Battleford and in Australia and in China and in London, England. And yes, it doesn't have a formal, recognizable structure with a straightforward agenda, because we're thinking globally and acting locally. And I'm sure you've heard that lots before. Well, folks are asking, as they're working alongside us, where do I start? How can I begin to work here? And how can I be a supportive ally for this kind of work? And part of the challenges, especially in Canada, is we've grown up with the belief that us Canadians are both multicultural and good in comparison to the Americans, just to simplify that a little bit. But what it does is it shifts our vision away from the way in which federal politics has become increasingly more corporate, okay, and corporate influenced. And so that kind of blinds us from our focus. And so what I need folks to do is start to shift away from individual work ethic or that idea of meritocracy, and start to see the way that the corporations are starting to inform the agendas of our federal government. It's no surprise to me that XL Pipeline and some of the other pipelines that have been going through require agreements between the U.S. and Canada and also Mexico. And they're changing. The corporations have changed the legislation because they want that, they need that agreement, right? And instead of looking at the way that the corporations are influencing legislation and being annoyed by that or ticked off by that or outspoken about that, people are tending to shift their gaze back to First Nations and saying, well, they closed that highway or they stopped that railway. Those bad Indians, they're in the way of progress. And so there's this discourse that's happening between the good thing that the government's feeding us around job creation and growth. And then there's this bad thing that has to do with the Indians are in the way of progress. Isn't that an old colonial narrative from way back? Isn't it just recycling itself here? So understanding some of the shared history of colonization and how it's being repeated back to us today is a really important starting point. My students often will say that they don't need to organize themselves as white people. They just simply are. They're just, you know, I'm a good person. I want to do good work. But they don't realize and they don't recognize that their own race privilege allows for a particular kind of narrative to be repeated. And it also doesn't allow them to take a look in which their own privilege is replicated in that setting. So they see themselves as benefiting from this corporate model, right? Because it means job growth and creation. And they buy into that idea. Well, my brother's working in the oil field, they tell me, and he's making good money, and now he can buy a house, and off they go. So what I need from my allies, just to get things going, is a recognition that they are, in fact, white. Because us along the margins, we see it. We call you that. In the same way that we are often labeled as First Nations or Black or whatever it happens to be, we actually do see color. And we live with that experience of being a colored person in relation to whiteness. And so I actually, from my allies, I need them to recognize and name themselves as white as a starting point. Otherwise, that denial becomes a barrier to our collective work, just on the surface. I won't even waste my time after that. If somebody comes up to me and says, Dr. Pete, I'm not white. And I'll say, well, what are you? Because I see it. And it's real to me. And then the next layer of our collaboration comes in recognizing the kind of privilege that flows to whiteness out of a system that creates both superiority and oppression. Because it's not just about keeping the bad Indians in their place and keeping them on the reserve and keeping them on welfare and those kinds of things. It's also about allowing for privilege to flow to the dominant group. I found it really interesting about a week ago. I was in a coffee shop, and there was a young white male there, and he was talking about how there was a housing incentive for him to build a new house in Regina, and that he was eligible for it, so he was taking advantage of it, and he was going to do it, and this was all great. And I said, isn't it interesting that when folks closer to the norm in society are given an incentive, it's got that label on it, it's not called a handout. And so we even shift our language, but isn't it still the same thing? So I find that kind of fascinating too. So we ended up having a brief conversation, but the coffee shop's not necessarily the best place for that sort of thing. There's a lineup and people waiting, and anyway, we let the moment pass. So what I need from my allies, and I often tell them this, is there's so much information out here. Please begin to read about the omnibus bill as well as other things, but learn about the ideas that are being presented in it. I'm an education professor. You know, I spend my time teaching courses in racism and that type of thing, and identity development. But I've had to do a lot of work to learn about the water management changes, the legislative changes to water management in this country. And I've had to do a lot of work to the legislative changes that are going to impact on the pipelines being able to move right across our country and take the oil reserves out of the West and send them both to the Atlantic provinces, China, and down to Texas area and beyond into South America. I've had to learn all of that, and certainly it takes lots of time, but in order to be able to speak more and help more as an ally, I have to know that stuff. So I've had to make a commitment to learn and read and grow. For educators that I work with, I challenge them to create authentic relationships with racial others. And my students often tell me that there's very few places that they go where they have to integrate with people who are racially diverse. Their recreation usually doesn't have much racial diversity. Their places of worship have not much diversity. Their places they choose to go to hang out with their friends, not a lot of racial diversity. And if it is, it's over there. And they can maintain that disconnect from interacting. One of my students, she came to me and she said, Dr. Pete, you're the first Indian I've ever talked to in Saskatchewan. And I thought, oh my goodness, This is a terrible responsibility I have. I'm not the best, you know. I'm pretty good, but I don't represent everybody. And then one of my friends, a First Nations woman, said to me, "How many white people have you had to your house?" And I sat back and I said, "I've lived here 8 years. And besides the woman who comes by once a year to collect for the Diabetes Association, I couldn't think of any." And I thought, I have work to do too, don't I? Because it's not just a one-way responsibility. It's a two-way responsibility. So I'm going to look for white folks to have over for tea. I'll take you up on that one. Because I need some diversity too in my life. And that knowing full well that there's no right way to enter into either that authentic relationship or into that ally relationship. My students often shut down, and as do some of my colleagues. One of my friends called me into the hallway one day. He goes, "Can you come? Do you have a minute? I have to introduce the elders next week. How do I do that?" And I was like, "Well, you do lots of presentations, right?" And he says, "Yes." And I said, "You speak at conferences all the time?" "Yes." "It's kind of the same. Like, you can't screw this up. Here's Elder so-and-so. He's from such-and-such, and he's going to be joining us today." So that was about it. And he goes, "Okay, all right. Well, what about the tobacco thing?" And I said, "Okay, well, I'll teach you about protocol." And again, I said, when you're offering protocol or tobacco to your elder guests or to your traditional knowledge keepers, there's no right way to do this. You kind of have to humble yourself and say, this is stuff I don't know, and I'm kind of scared, but I'd like to ask you to come and speak with our group or come and tell stories or share your experiences with or whatever it happens to be. So it's mostly all up here. You have to get clear with yourself about what you want. And then doing it, and then it's like, that wasn't so bad. I talked with a teacher colleague one day, and she said to me, "I knew that I had to ask the elder to come in to do a particular type of thing, and I'm holding the tobacco in my office, and my hands are shaking, and I started to cry, and I'm thinking, why am I so freaked out?" Because I was afraid of being judged by the racial other. And she said, "What am I, silly? Just because I haven't had a whole lot of experience with this, of course I'm a little bit afraid, but I'll get over it." And after the fact, as she's walking back to her office, she said, "I lost nothing. I lost no status from bumbling along with my introduction. I lost no privileges from being humbled and stumbling over my words and showing my emotion. I lost nothing." And that's an okay thing to know. And certainly her work with elders now is done more naturally. There's less tears. And she does it a little bit more authentically as well. So there's no right way to ask for participation and being an ally in relationships. There's just no right way. Just move forward into it. Enter into that discomfort of wanting to cross the line between you and I and us and them. And sometimes we have to be prepared to be told that's enough. And there's lots of spaces that those closer to norm go to where it's all easy and they get their way and it's always welcomed and those kinds of things, but not so much for when you're on the other side of things. And so we have to be prepared to deal with the embarrassment or maybe a little shame or discomfort from being told, that's enough. You're overstepping a boundary with me in this authentic relationship that we're trying to create, and that we'll get through it. Okay? We'll find another way of working with one another. And then another piece is for me is the keeping working together. Because we will learn some things from conflict. We will learn some things from when we don't agree or we communicate differently and there's some friction. We will get through it. And that too is a teaching. And it's a teaching in humility and forgiveness. And it's a teaching in love. Right? And we keep moving on. And then the last thing for me is that for my white allies, I ask them, use your position of privilege to support the work that we're doing collectively, because you're really influential. And I know when you say something, people listen. And when I say something and it's usually quite exactly the same, people think I'm political. Right? Because when a brown woman speaks, it comes off as angry. So use that position of privilege in an influential way to challenge some of those coffee shop conversations that you overhear, or to confront some of the politicians that you're working with, or in your other circles of influence, not only here, but elsewhere in your life. Use those that privileged positioning to extend a message, correct a misunderstanding, and to provide new knowledge to other people. So on the surface, this work of ally, it's kind of mucky. It's a little messy. There's no real clear way how to go about doing it. But certainly, it is a place for growth for all of us, because we really do want to work alongside our allies to address some of those major big environmental issues in particular. You know, and we can take on the ones around the Indian Act, but it wouldn't hurt if you ask the question too, where are the Indians in the process of redefining the Indian Act? That might help. It might go far with this government. And the last thing I wanted to ask you is this question. We need help. We're a fairly young community who hasn't had a long history with activism. We haven't had a long history because it was actually illegal for us to get together for a time under the Indian Act. It was illegal for us to come together to dance. So even with the round dances that have been happening publicly, those seem like still like acts of defiance, you know, because we still are living under that Indian Act in some ways. But what now? There's a lot of young people in this movement, and many of them have not the kind of history of activism, and they don't know what the next stage looks like. But it does feel like we need to keep that surge of collaborative conversation going and take it up a notch, especially around the environmental issues. So I want to throw that back to you. How can you help us to rethink what next? And how might that look for both of us, all of us, going forward? So that's kind of my challenge to you folks, too. I'd love to have that conversation with you. Prior to coming here, I spoke with friends and allies in Saskatoon. There's a number of people in the academic community and certainly in the activism community who are saying, what next? And they're saying, how can we get out to other community organizations that maybe we haven't touched base with before? And I said, the folks here at the Unitarian Congress or Unitarian Church have invited me to come in to visit and have this conversation with them. You might want to check out the allies in Saskatoon and see what whether invitations could be forthcoming for you there too, so that we can bring in other diverse groups to this collective work. So I think that's the stage that we're at now. Yeah, and I'm just interested in hearing, what would you suggest for us going forward? Yes, sir.
You said that planning is being done on the $1 trillion stage. And I have a friend who has been to the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. I've been very friend who, I have an uncle who's in charge of the eastern half of the Geological Survey of Canada. And I wore Eskimo moccasins when I was a kid. And the international standard of cost accounting in geology is shared by the Geological Survey of Canada and the Soviet Union. So, I mean, what happens is the massive military expenditures that are being made are nationalistic, and as such, are characterizing a play which emphasizes, de-emphasizes Soviet privilege of the economics of the system and risks genocidal spending. And that means the Russian point of view is that it won't cost to count the major investors of Bay Street and Wall Street successfully in terms of engineering practice of permafrost and high Arctic black tundra, and studies that have been done on that issue. It's simply not proper engineering to expect that kind of massive expenditure to be made successfully from the point of interest to the investor and to the big stock exchanges. And I think that's a big risk.
Do you have a question for me?
Do you have any way of addressing the Soviet embassy to confirm this issue?
That's a really good question, because I think one of the things that it draws my attention to is how global these issues are and at how far the corporate reaches for me. It's just astounding. And then it reminds me again the question, so what can we do? Right? How can we work together when we're dealing with this global movement? And I don't have any connections in other locations in this way, but it does concern me, because I think, how do we ever deal with those issues? How do we slow them down? Even in the news this week, we see the expansion of conversation of moving the oil from the pipelines in the west to the east, and they're moving ahead regardless of whether we dissent, regardless of the protests, regardless of whatever we do. Those deals are already moving forward, and what is our next steps?
Dr. Pete, we've got a microphone here, so Terry will kind of keep track of everybody, and I'm claiming privilege because I'm standing here with the mic. I just wanted to say that the Unitarian Fellowship here has decided to host a treaty education workshop on March 16th, so that's one step we're taking. It's just a small one, but it's a way to start at least ourselves learning more, and it'll be open to the community. And I just wanted to ask, and I'm not sure if there's time for this, but there was an article apparently in the Globe and Mail that talked about the use of the word nation, and you touched on labels a bit yourself by saying that you change depending on the place or situation, but this article was basically saying that the word nation, maybe as white people understand it, is possibly not the same as how First Nations understand it.
And certainly, I agree with that. For us, as First Nations people here, I always think back to the story my dad tells me, and I said it last time, but I'm going to say it again because it's what helps ground the answer for me. My dad tells me the story about back in the day, way back in the day, there was a gathering of 10,000 teepees on the banks of the Missouri River. And in that space, each of the different nations came forward and they negotiated the terms of that occupation of that particular space in a temporary way. They negotiated trade routes, and they negotiated family alliances and marriages, and they traded product back and forth. And they did so in a multilingual way with translators from within each of the different nations. And in their view, we've always had a multinational occupation of the Americas, right? Because we represent all of these different First Nations groups. And so from our point of view, the nations were already here. And it's not much different from the nations that developed elsewhere. So we see ourselves in a very similar type of fashion. But you're right, that hasn't been universally accepted by our governments and by the structures around us. They tend to like to keep us as a racialized group as opposed to nations of our own.
I'm just over in the corner again. I'm wondering about the voting that is reflected in the First Nations communities, and although voting in the collective has gone down, I think, anyway, and the voting average age is 50-something, so kind of reflects how engaged people are in general. And I really like the title of Idle No More for the group that has taken on action. And I wonder if how the voting process is seen in general in the voting in the First Nations communities, because one of the conversations I saw online was that it's a colonial process as well, and you know, how much do you take that on in order to create change in a system that is having so much effect on a certain groups or many groups? So I just wanted to know what your view on that was.
Well, certainly, I've been around since 65, and most of my family members have been both socially active in resistance, and resistance to the colonizing models that have been imposed on them. But at the same time, they've been engaged at a very high level of civic engagement, both in First Nations politics, Métis politics, and in the mainstream politics, because our voices can't get lost in that. And we're constantly having to speak our way into it, into the mainstream politics. So for my folks in our community, my family in particular, we're very outspoken and participating at a very high level. That isn't to say that that is part of the adopted norms of our other generations of folks or of people in other locations. But I think at this point it's created a really strong conversation about leverage in our communities. We are a rising young population with our, we're going to be representing 40% of the school population here in Regina. In a very short period of time, probably within the next 2 to 3 years, will be 40% of the K-12 system. We have to acknowledge that we have a wonderful opportunity to use our privilege of numbers, to our best advantage to help shape some of the social policies that will be operating here. And we can't let that opportunity slide. So we are trying to educate these generations that social engagement is really, really important right now, and that our votes do count. We suspect, though, that the recent changes to immigration laws are to counteract our rising population, just at a point when we are getting to a point where our numbers are such we could actually shift the power structures a little bit. And so you, as a federal government or a provincial government, you counteract that by rising the immigration population. So we're suspicious of that already. And at the same time, I'm loving that you're asking the question, because we are actively moving to use our numbers.
Thank you. Yeah, I have a question, because you major on business administration, and I was wondering, it's a question I'm going to ask in two steps, and what is the answer from the business community with regard to their development in First Nation? And therefore, what is, because there was a couple of years ago, they were saying, oh, Treaty Number 6, they're going to cross the land from Treaty Number 6, then they have to go and talk to Treaty Number 6. Elders and chiefs and so on to be able to. So what is the answer? Because every time you have a project going through, and it's not just for Saskatchewan, it's for all across Canada, every time there's something going on, they have to develop a plan, propose a plan to the government, and the government, therefore, it's available to First Nation to see this particular plan, and therefore to go directly to the company and to the board of directors and say, okay, now we have to talk between you and I. So that's my question.
You bet. Well, and I love this question too, because again, it goes back to the global movement for Indigenous peoples under the UN Declaration for Indigenous Peoples' Rights, and the duty to consult, to the duty for prior and informed consultation is coming directly from the UN, and it's to apply to all Indigenous nations globally. In particular, in Saskatchewan, like many groups of people or different organizations, we want to do things ethically and responsibly. And the challenge for us is how to build business and be sustainable at the same time. And I don't think that difference is much, I don't think that concern is much different from many Canadian citizens' concerns. We can't keep to, I'm going to back up now. So in terms of the negotiations with us, we are in this really awkward position of trying at once to be both ethical and sustainable and keeping that at the forefront of our thinking. But we're also the most structurally disadvantaged. So we don't have representation in employment. So our communities are having to do this dance between employment opportunities, predominantly in the oil and gas industry, or sustainability. And so it's a really awkward position to be in. And now, not every First Nations, as I said, are treaty bands or treaty peoples. So some of them already have self-government agreements in place. And so we see an unequal consultation process with those who are already self-governing and with those who are treaty bands and treaty governments. And so there's pressure there between the two, because we do see an unfair advantage for some bands where resources are flowing to them individually. We suspect partly because of coercion. They want the money up front in this generation as opposed to the land down the road later on. And so we question both, we question sovereignty, ethics, and sustainability agendas for them. Businesses and governments have not wanted to deal with us on an individual basis. And for some First Nations people, we don't want to maintain the machine of Indian Affairs anymore, or Aboriginal Affairs in Northern Development Canada, because the resources flow to them in a way that privileges that operation anyway. And moving forward, if they have to administer the relationship between corporations and individual First Nations, all we're going to do is grow AANDC, the Aboriginal Affairs and Northern Development Corporation. It'll actually have to grow bigger in order to facilitate that kind of negotiations under the current administration. If we can move forward on self-governance, then businesses will have to come in and deal with us in a more fair way. I wouldn't say that that's even happened yet. My dad was asked to sit in on a meeting last month, and there were some Chinese investors looking at starting a corporation in Alberta with one of the bands there. And the corporation was going to help, that the intention was to help them to create a housing organization. So they would create a factory to build houses, like prefab houses. And the Chinese businessmen were really forceful. And they said, no, you don't know. You don't understand. We are going to do this. You just have to sign this. And they used a lot of coercive and inappropriate business practices to undermine the band council's decision making. And even though on the one hand it looked like a good business opportunity, it meant selling rights to the land. It meant some other things that were written in that contract, and that coercive nature of it was just unacceptable. And in this particular case, the chief didn't feel he was being heard, and he asked my dad to intervene. And my dad just said, close your briefcases, gentlemen, and out you go, because we're not doing business with you. And as they were leaving, you are foolish. You are stupid peoples. You'll never get through anything. You know, you'll never accomplish anything. So they really individualized the shame. And I don't think that that's helpful otherwise, because we don't need other people to colonize us. Okay. There's one in the back, too. Or...
we'll take one more quick comment or question. I'm sorry, but we're out of time. Okay. We had a person up here already that wanted to ask, and perhaps Dr. Pete would be willing to stay afterwards for
Absolutely.
A little while and have further conversation.
You bet.
When you're talking about needing groups of allies, are there any such groups in Regina now?
Absolutely there are. And I have to really commend a number of the different unions who've jumped on board to provide their support and do their letter writing campaigns from internally. So like CUPE was one of the unions that jumped on board right away. The auto workers, of all people, they all showed up and said, you know, they sent their notifications that they were allies to the movement as well, which I found really fascinating. And then here, Keep Saskatchewan Green was one of the organizations, the Anti-Poverty League, and I believe it was Saskatchewan Coalition for Anti-Racism, something like that. I forgot the title of it. Anyway, there were a number of them that came forward and said, we're going to help support this movement and we'll do our own education from internal.
So is there any discussion among Native groups about trying to form a group of allies and inviting people to join?
You know, here's the challenge. some of the First Nations chiefs, and there's 74 First Nations in this province, some of them are currently privileged by their relationships they have with the oil and gas industry, and they're already receiving payouts or they're already negotiating for lease agreements. So they were already in bed with the corporations. And so I wouldn't say they are Idle No More supporters. And they are not actively looking for allies, because if they keep their mouth shut and keep the focus off of them, nobody will know that they're already getting privileged from the existing structures. So there was an announcement earlier this week from Chief Belrose saying that he's not going to touch it, and you know they're going to move forward on their agreements with the industries. So I'm concerned about how that's already played out. I won't say that you're going to find First Nations chiefs as a collective asking for allies. What you're going to find is individuals who are looking, and small groups of activist groups who are looking for support. All right? Thanks.
You're welcome.